You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. Okay, OGDT, this is one of the last episodes of Dark Topic from the original stuff that I have. And you can't hear the train on these episodes that I talk about, but there it is behind me now, which is fun. So I hope that you enjoyed the last of what's not available out there. Icecock does like stay paranoid, talking real soon with some new stuff. I'm here to give you the podcast that I always wanted to hear myself. A no-holds-barred straight dose of reality with moments of levity thrown in to keep the content palatable. It hasn't been perfect thus far, but I can honestly say it's my best shot. I now know how hunters feel. They're always having to explain their love of nature draws them to the practice, and that's hard to understand. But I'll bet that a hunter, a morally sound hunter, that is, knows way more about preserving wildlife than a tree-hugging hippie. And I love tree-hugging hippies, I'm just saying. I'll bet that the hunter is more educated, because they're immersed in the subject, whereas the hippie's just enjoying the feel of the water on their feet. Maybe not. Hippies have some notoriously dirty-ass feet, but you know what I'm saying. I immerse myself in these topics, and like an old, fetch-weary dog, I step out of them and shake all the knowledge I've soaked up onto you, the listener. So if you don't like getting wet, stand back. Or just stop throwing me the stick. The Candyman. Dean Corll was born on Christmas Eve, 1939, in Fort Wayne, Indiana, to parents Arnold and Mary. Mary was a doting mother. Arnie was indifferent, stating openly that he couldn't appreciate children. Even so, a couple years after Dean was born, the two had another son together. But babies don't strengthen weak relationships. And in 1946, six-year-old Dean's parents separated, his father moving to Memphis, where he had been drafted into the Air Force. Mary pulled up roots and followed, wanting her boys to grow up with a father accessible. Arnie said, whatever, and young Dean Corll entered the school system, disillusioned and confused by the instability that colors too many of our childhoods. The two soon got back together, but the bickering continued. This would last another 3 years before they divorced for the final time. Meanwhile, Dean soldiered on. It said that he was picked on in school. At the age of 7, he had suffered from an undiagnosed case of rheumatic fever, which is an inflammatory disorder caused by a rare form of strep throat. The fever causes the body to inadvertently attack itself, namely the connective tissue in the joints, causing painful arthritis. But it also affects the heart valves, brain, and the heart itself. This affliction killed many children before penicillin hit the market in 1960, but Dean survived. He escaped with a heart murmur, which kept him sidelined during gym class and doomed him to become a wimp in the eyes of his classmates. Young Dean Corll became a recluse and a loner. He also became a little weird, at one point taking a shine to trapping flying squirrels, which he turned into necklaces and wear about town, doing himself no favors. Other than this, there's nothing that really stands out. Of course, almost anything we have to report on young Dean Coral comes from his mother. The only blood relative willing to talk about Dean once his eventual crimes were literally unearthed. Dean's mother found love again and wed a traveling salesman, and the two had a daughter together. Mary was always baking, and soon the two decided to turn her skills into a money-making venture. They bought the equipment necessary to shake down pecans and started up a sweet treat business based out of their garage called Pecan Prince. I know most of you probably prefer pecans to pecans, but a pecan is something truckers covertly toss out their windows, and a pecan is an upper-class nut that Dean was about to be thrown full-time into procuring and processing. His mother would gussy them up, and the new dad would distribute them through his sales route, which ran through the larger metropolis of Houston. Looks like I missed a tidbit of research here that his family now lived outside of Houston, Texas. But let's be honest, we're not paying that kind of attention at this point. Rheumatic fever, flying squirrels, and pecans. You with me? In 1964, when Dean was in his mid-20s, he was drafted into the Army and soon found himself in Fort Hood, Texas, serving as a radio repairman. Less than a year into his service, Dean was returned home after his mother applied for and succeeded in earning her son a hardship discharge, claiming that she simply couldn't run the candy business without him. The business had migrated to a small factory across from an elementary school in an area of Houston known as the Heights. The Heights was a more run-down part of the city, and Dean quickly took to the neighborhood's children, offering the kids from the elementary school any extras or damaged yet edible pieces of candy, earning himself the description of the man with the candy, and later more infamously as the Candy Man of the Heights, or the Pied Piper. Dean had a new stepfather by this time, a sailor who Mary met via one of the original dating machines. I picture a Goliath of a computer taking in Mary's Scantron card of preferences and spitting out the semen. Ooh. Spitting, okay. Sometimes I lay traps for myself when I write. Must have been in the wine that night, spitting out the semen. Anywho, this new seafaring hubby voiced some discomfort at how Dean was warming up to the young boys in the neighborhood, and soon found himself kicked to the curb by Mama Bear Mary, who always took Dean's side and chalked up any perceived odd behavior from Dean as being the result of coming from a broken home. As time went on and Pecan Prince became Coral Candy Company, of which Dean by this point ran tirelessly and almost exclusively, his former stepfather had started up his own candy business and competition was fierce. Employees became necessary. He hired at least 5 women to work the line, but also brought on local teens to help out around the factory. Dean was a pleasant employer by all accounts, but would take breaks from time to time in the back of the factory when his stress levels rose. It's not known what Coral would do to relieve himself back in what became known as his, quote, pouting room, but when he'd returned from a spell in there, he was always refreshed. Coral had this room dug out at one point and was known to take on projects that involved trenching, some that he undertook alone at night in his, I think it was where they grow the pecans and candy apples. He dug up quite a bit. And later on, the cops didn't have much interest in checking out what he was doing all out there. This behavior raised no alarms at the time, but, I mean, knowing what we know now, many people believe that Coral was being a major fucking creep way before he met the accomplices from who we have almost all the information I'm able to share with you here. Who knows what Coral was up to on the side or before the first known victim, but my guess is he wasn't playing euchre with his mama. A woman of whom many noticed that Dean treated as though he were the parent in the relationship. Dean installed a black light and a pool table, which attracted the friends of his employees, and soon enough he had a popular teen hangout on his hands. One of the boys, David Brooks, was 12 years old when he first met Dean. Brooks was a quiet, skinny sixth grader who wore glasses and hid behind his hair. His parents had divorced, and Brooks spent much of his time at the candy factory, where Dean Coral quickly took a liking to the withdrawn young man, perhaps seeing a little of himself in the boy. Brooks began to see Coral as a father figure over time. Coral would give Brooks money and offer for the boy to stay at his apartment that sat above the candy factory. When Brooks' family split and he was forced to travel between homes, this was apparently a place where he went and not a problem in the eyes of Brooks' parents, who by all accounts were indifferent to the routines of their son by this point. Not an unusual relationship between child and parent and the worn-out Heights area. Speaking of worn-out, the police in this part of Houston were conveniently, to Coral at least, spread thin due to the fact that the chief proudly waved off any additional funding and As a result, many officers had to hold second jobs on account of their low wages. The homicide division in Houston was a group comprised of less than 50 men at this time, and local crews in the Heights were known to shirk off calls and duties to the evening shift as though they worked in a non-consequential factory setting rather than a completely consequential public services gig. The police force's mentality was akin to, say, a local volunteer fire department who hasn't seen a check for a year or so. I know that sounds funny, a volunteer fire department getting a check, but they do get paid at these places. $17 an hour around here, I believe. Anyways, this police force reminds me of a volunteer fire department who hasn't seen their pay for the year. They did what they could when they could, or maybe more accurately, what they chose to do when they felt up to doing so. I've often spoken of the time machine at which we should avoid setting to around 1973. Coral perhaps was a listener of this podcast and took advantage. He couldn't have been in a better spot for what he was about to begin inflicting upon the young men of the Heights. Now, in the beginning, I warned you about my intentions henceforth, so you one-star assassins who call me classless or a profiteer of murder can... I'm not profiting anything, by the way. Well, I think $100 on Patreon at this point. You can leave now, if you haven't already. This old dog's tired and my fur's full of swamp water. Go grab a latte and watch a friend's rerun. The rest of us are fixing to get soaked facing this thing. But first a side street. Grab a drink here. I got... going with the rum today. Rum and grapefruit juice. It's halfway to a halfway to a Hemingway. Like Hemingway drank a drink like that. Hemingway drank a lot of drinks. All right. Let's get out of the way that young David Brooks was getting paid to receive oral sex from Coral by the time he was 13. It's impossible to say if this was the first time Dean had crossed the line with one of the kids he had positioned himself to be surrounded by, but it's possible. Brooks was the ideal target for a predator like Dean Coral, and Coral would groom the impressionable young man to become an accomplice before long, a step further than most pedophiles go. Usually they rely on the shame of their victim to keep the offenses under wraps, but Coral had grandiose plans for his first protege. I myself worked for a sexual predator at a pizza joint when I was 17 or so. I didn't mention it in my preamble for fear of turning off listeners. These personal comparable stories must be getting a little hard to believe. Regardless, hold on to your butts. This is the reason why I even tackled this distasteful case. My sexual predator didn't give me blowjobs, but he certainly offered them. I was a polite young guy, and he mistook this for weakness. I ended up working as a short-order cook for him and his life partner and politely staved off his request for me to... He requested that I jerk off in a milk bottle and leave it on his doorstep for him. The guy was a full-on sexual predator. His name was Jerry, a little pudgy Latin man who looked exactly like the actor Louis Guzman. Look him up or don't. He resembled a hedgehog, if that helps. He owned this pizza place called Big Boy's Pizza Burgers and Wings, of which we all wore t-shirts that proudly advertised the intentionally cheeky tagline, quote, "Where thickness is an obsession." Quote. You can't make this up. He was from Detroit, where he told me he'd been an orphan and eventual street kid who turned tricks until he met his life partner, a former teacher and Vietnam War vet. I'd be remiss to not mention that this guy was huge, this partner of Jerry's. 6'5 and weighed at least 350. He was black, unlike me. Also unlike me, his name was Bill. I loved this man. Cried when I heard he died of an inevitable heart attack in 2005. He once drove me to an audition to be a clown for sick kids. He waited out front as I did my thing, and when I came out looking disillusioned, he said to me, "Let the clowns be clowns, friend," and handed me a cigarette. "No harm in trying," he consoled as we drove away in his maroon Jeep. Then he asked, "Does Jerry ever say anything off to you or anyone else?" I told him no. That was a lie. I lied a lot back then. Anyways, the two of them were clearly running from some trouble. I deduced that Jerry had probably been in hot water before as a result of his predatory nature, and that Bill was basically hiding his love. The business was entirely in his name. Bill would often repeat to me this, quote, "It's a great life if you don't weaken. Just don't get weak, friend. End quote. I spent a lot of time with these guys for some reason. I know what it was. I'd been through a breakup with like my first girlfriend and had been arrested for mischief around this time in an incident involving stolen wine and broken bottles. I had spent half a night in a holding cell refusing to give up any information. These so-called friends had been released almost immediately, having spilled the beans and pointed the finger at myself and my best friend at the time, who got roughed up by police that night for using his brother's name, who had charges as well. The police had just been teaching me a lesson for not complying. I mean, I was all in. Snitches, stitches, ditches. Right, guys? Guys? Anyways, after being dragged through court over the stupid incident, I pretty much had no friends that I wanted to be around, so I became a regular at Big Boys. Jerry and Bill started calling me their white love child, which was super weird, but in a way flattering. I just enjoyed their company. They were completely different from anyone I'd ever met. Business was extremely slow. Jerry was way too much for most people. Extremely flamboyant. He scared off every customer with his nonstop chatter. Jerry thought we needed to let the world know the Big Boys were here, and soon had me approaching cars at the stoplights downtown and pushing flyers in the faces of shocked commuters. The Who's from Whoville, he called them. This advertising practice was well-worn in big American cities like his hometown of Detroit, but in small-town Canada, the police pulled up 2 days in and told me to stop. I then went door-to-door introducing the business. I had call center experience, so I cold-called everyone in the phone book, offering their specials. Free bottle of milk with every order. We smoked like chimneys in this place. Me making the owners lunch and dinner. The establishment's main customers. Eventually, the kids started showing up. There was a group home nearby, and one young man in particular became the regular I'd once been before being hired on. I worked beside an Afghani named Mustafa, who was a half-hearted Muslim and super smart. Jerry and Bill had poached him from a pizza joint near Toronto. He was a funny guy. We'd often imitate the owners, pretending to be gay with one another. Mustafa would on occasion approach me from behind as I battered potato wedges, ignoring the flour weevils they die in the fryer, and wrap his arms around me, whispering in my ear in his heavy accent, "Thickness is an obsession." It was a great time. I know I'm doing a poor job of selling it, but honestly, I've never laughed so much in my life. It was ridiculous. But the fun abruptly halted when Jerry started taking the aforementioned new boy downstairs. These were at-risk youth who had become regulars, many of whom had already been taken advantage of, so were an easy target for Jerry. I would later work in this same group home. Strange stuff. Money began going missing from the till. Bill asked me if Jerry was messing with the kids. I told him I didn't know, which was true. He asked me to call him if anything unusual happened. Bill was having health issues at this point and spent a lot of time upstairs, resting. I called him soon after this to tip him off that Jerry had just gone downstairs with his new regular team. This kid was a little older than David Brooks had been when Coral sprung his trap, 15 or 16. I'll probably get a few of you on my case for not reporting any of this, but the age of consent in Canada at the time was 14. Now it's 14 if the relationship falls within 5 years of that age, I think, and 16 all around. I don't know if there's any laws against it being a guy-on-guy situation or a girl-on-girl back then. I don't know if the laws were that ignorant, but I wouldn't doubt it. Where was I? So Jerry was heading downstairs with this young guy. I was the only other person in the restaurant. So after asking me if I was good on my own, he looked at me seriously and said he was going to have a private talk with the kid about some issues he was having, and that if I needed him, to just stomp on the floor. He handed me a couple of smokes for my trouble then, headed down. As soon as he closed the door, I called Bill. Bill crept down from the apartment upstairs and quietly entered through the front door, being careful not to jangle the bells above it. I stood smoking behind the till, and he labored his large frame to the basement door, looking at me with a chagrined expression before he quietly headed down to break up the study session. Soon after this, Mustafa told Gil that he'd seen Barry giving this kid $5 from the register. 2 weeks later, I showed up to work, and Mustafa was sitting up front. The owners had always joked that they'd leave like gypsies in the night if the business didn't pick up, skipping out on their rent. I handed Mustafa a cigarette and we sat smoking in front of the abandoned Big Boys early one Sunday morning in the summer of 1998, I believe it was, joking about how we would never again have to endure the jeweled eyes of Jerry as he danced on the Friday night disco light he removed before vanishing, singing about how he loved the nightlife, of how he liked to boogie. As we parted ways, Mustafa shared that he'd seen Jerry doing something weird with the team downstairs that week and had told Bill. Mustafa's impression had been that Jerry was holding the teenager's dick for him while he pissed. Mustafa even asked me, why would he pay a kid to hold his dick while he pissed? I laughed. It's not so funny now. Although I just laughed again at it, and I didn't answer him. We hugged face to face for once and then wandered away from the place. I never saw Mustafa or the Big Boys again. Jerry was a version of Coral. He used his business as a sort of Venus flytrap. I've always been good at escaping a disaster at the last moment, believing that even though it may not seem as though I'm in control, I always had control. Now, after reading up on the Candyman, I know how lucky I was. Like Coral, Jerry had an apartment upstairs. I spent time up there with him and Bill. Special occasions like Christmas, Eve, and Thanksgiving. Had the Big Boys been more like Coral and his eventual two-man crew, I most definitely would have found myself tied to a torture board one of those nights. And today, I'd be in an unmarked grave somewhere, my genitals placed neatly beside me in a plastic bag. So to steer this thing back, 13-year-old David Brooks was getting paid by Coral to allow the now 30-something to give him blowjobs. Coral, despite his meek, clean-cut public persona, was a sadistic sexual predator unlike any the world had previously seen. We don't know why or how, as he took many of his secrets to the grave. But with the accounts of his accomplices, the second of which we'll soon meet, Coral was responsible for the deaths of at least 28 boys from the Houston Heights area and beyond, beginning in the post-Summer of Love, 1970, and ending in, you guessed it, 1973. Coral's mother closed the candy factory around 1970 and left for Colorado after talking to a psychic who said she needed to get away from her ex-husband. I believe she left an open invitation for Dean to join her if he ever wanted to head to greener pastures, but Coral was quite content with staying for reasons mysterious to his family. I, of course, now know that it was because he laid the groundwork for a parade of young men to churn through his wheelhouse. Coral easily picked up work as a relay tester for Houston Lighting and Power Company and began having small parties in a new apartment with the neighborhood kids, of which he lured with the promise of paint huffing, dope smoking, and beer drinking. Huffing paint was big back then. Indeed had shitloads of the good acrylic shit. David Brooks and Coral had become so tight that Brooks thought nothing of walking into Coral's apartment unannounced. On one of these occasions, Brooks walked into an incredibly disturbing scene. Coral had two boys tied up to a board and was sexually assaulting them in a brutal fashion. It's possible that Dee meant for Brooks to walk in on this in order to test the boy, but we'll never be sure. Coral told Brooks that he was just having a bit of fun. He promised Brooks a car if he kept quiet about it. David Brooks, after not much thought, agreed. Coral originally claimed that he was a part of a child sex ring and he had the boys in transit for sale to California. Brooks apparently nodded his shaggy head indifferently to this, looking like a young Jeff Dahmer as he exited the apartment nonchalantly. Coral promised Brooks $200 for any boys he can bring him, although Coral later admitted to Brooks that he killed those two boys once he'd finished with them. Brooks received a green Corvette for his loyalty, and the offer of cash for any boy he could lure to Coral still stood. Brooks was in. Dean Coral was the first person who'd ever treated him decently, and he wasn't about to turn on the Candyman, figuratively and literally. Despite their agreement, Coral could be mean at times, forcing himself upon his young protege. It's unclear how many boys, if any, Coral had murdered before hooking up with David Brooks. This scene that Brooks walked in on makes me feel as though Coral had been at it for a while, but again, we'll never know. What we do know is horrible enough in itself. I suggest you brace yourself for the deluge of sadistic torture and murder that came next. I'm out of anecdotes, and the crimes of the Candyman are pretty hard to digest. Not that my personal stories are all that appetizing. It's been said before about Dean Coral, but I'll say it again. He was the real-life monster Pennywise from Stephen King's It. Kids went missing all over the Heights during Coral's infamous spree, and the police didn't do a thing about it. They were chalked up as runaways. Boys who apparently hit the road with only a bathing suit and 80 cents. Boys who sent letters to the parents using a manner of speaking that clearly wasn't their own. Boys who made desperate calls home before the line went dead. All ignored, and assumed to be runaways. Until they were all discovered at once.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Dean Coral took his first known victim on September 25th of 1970. Jeffrey Conan was an 18-year-old student studying at the University of Texas when he faithfully decided to hitchhike home to Houston for the weekend. Conan's parents reported him missing, but because of his age, police showed little concern. Conan was described as a bright guy and a small-statured young man, which may have initially fooled Coral into thinking he was younger. Regardless, Jeffrey Conan was found amongst the dead that would later be exhumed at remote High Island Beach in East Texas after Coral's eventual death. Jeffrey Conan had been buried in plastic beneath a layer of lime. He was naked, his hands and feet bound, and had died of asphyxiation as a result of strangulation. A couple months later, on December 13th, 1970, two 14-year-old buddies named Jimmy Glass and Danny Yates got up from a pew at a church service as if to go to the restroom, one witness recalled, and disappeared. Missing person reports were soon filed, but police weren't convinced that anything nefarious had happened to the boys. More likely, they'd taken off as runaways. 2 weeks before Christmas, sure. The reports ended up on two different investigators' desks, so the disappearances weren't even being treated as connected. The families were on their own to search for their sons, and search they did. Danny Yates' father heard from someone that a boy who looked just like his son had been seen in Monterrey, Mexico. The desperate father, who by this point was blaming his son's runaway status on himself for being too hard on his boy, drove the 500 miles to Monterrey where he found no trace of his son and eventually was forced to make the long drive back, alone and tortured. Jimmy Glass's family handed out flyers forever. Jimmy's mother would regularly believe she'd seen Jimmy while driving around with her husband. Jimmy's father would turn the vehicle around to check it out every time this happened, knowing that it likely hadn't been his son, but not having the heart to shoot down his wife's hope. Jimmy's brother Willie even ran an ad in the local paper, directly communicated towards his lost sibling, promising to buy the boy a motorcycle if he'd just return home. Dean Coral had rented a boat shed the month previous to these boys disappearing. While their families desperately searched, Glass and Yates lay buried beneath this shed, wrapped in plastic, and mercifully dead after the sadistic, torturous deaths they'd each experienced. Coral moved frequently so as not to raise the suspicion of neighbors. His methods of torture must have provoked a lot of noise. which he would dampen either by gagging his victims or blasting the radio, or both. I'll get into the details of some of these young men's deaths as I continue here, but it's difficult to be entirely accurate as Coral died with his secrets and his first accomplice, David Brooks, holds his cards pretty close to the vest. We'll meet Coral's second chosen accomplice in a minute here, who was a lot more helpful in opening a window to air out the murder spree of the Candyman. Not so much because he felt it was the right thing to do as it was because he simply couldn't keep his mouth shut. What we know is bad enough without wishing for more, I suppose. Coral had a torture board that he would fasten his victims to, then rape, torture, and kill them. He had thin glass tubes that he would occasionally insert into the penises of these unfortunate young men, and then smash. He'd pull out their pubic hairs one by one with his teeth, or with pliers, or his fingers. He would sodomize them with an oversized sex toy. Coral was an insatiable monster. He has faded into the background as one of the lesser-known infamous killers of all time, and I believe one of the main reasons is because of how off-putting his crimes were. Another reason would be that he died before we could get his side of the story in 1973, and yet another being that 5 years after the Candyman's crimes came to public attention, John Wayne Gacy in his clown suit overtook Coral's status as the most prolific serial killer in history with crimes very similar to Coral's. Maybe even mimicked in certain ways that we'll continue to rediscover here. On January 30th, 1971, 6 weeks after Jimmy Glass and Danny Yates went missing, brothers Donald, 15, and Jerry, 13, were headed to a bowling alley when a white Econoline van, the type that kidnappers and terrorists are known to drive, pulled up alongside them. David Brooks asked the boys if they wanted to party at his friend Dean's house. Dean, who was driving, likely smiled approvingly at his new accomplice as the Waldrop brothers excitedly piled into the back. Maybe stopped at a train crossing and watched a fucking monster train go by. Later that day, these boys were treated in a way that almost made me drop this episode. Coral eventually managed to get the siblings handcuffed side by side in his torture board. This board was a long piece of plywood, 8 feet tall, 2.5 feet wide, I believe, with holes in it to run rope through and secure cuffs. It would usually sit atop plastic so his victims could be rolled off afterwards and wrapped up. It's been said that Coral would wait until a boy fell asleep or passed out from partying before he would sneak up and cuff them. Huffing paint is conducive to, you know, passing out eventually. But sometimes he'd play a game where he'd get one of his accomplices to show a boy their ability to get out of handcuffs. Once they performed the trick, which consisted of them having a key, they would offer the victim a chance to try. This is a trick that Gacy would later use as well, a little gift from Candyman to Clown. Coral raped and tortured these boys until he was satisfied, then proposed a particularly cruel idea. He and Brooks were going to take off for a bit. When they returned, if one of the brothers had beaten the other to death with a free hand, they'd be spared. Killers leave, and eventually the boys take to half-heartedly beating on one another. When Coral and Brooks return, the Waldrop brothers are still very much alive. They are then strangled to death and later transferred to a coffin box Coral has installed in his van. A box the boys may have used to sit on during their ride to Coral's. They will be a part of the group found wrapped in plastic under the boat shed in 1973. Even though the Waldrop brothers lived only half a mile from the church that Yates and Glass went missing from, police failed to connect the dual boy disappearances that occurred less than 2 months apart. Just another case of runaways off to join that hippie circus. Everett Waldrop, the father of Donald and Jerry, had this to say about his experience trying to get the attention of authorities after his sons went missing. Quote, "I camped on that police department door for 8 months. I was there about as much as the chief was. But all they said was, 'Why are you here? You know your boys are runaways.' They treated me like I was some sort of idiot." End quote. Coral and Brooks would strike again on March 9th of 71, just over a month since they murdered the Waldrop brothers. 15-year-old Randall Harvey was biking home from a shift at a gas station when Brooks and Coral rolled up on him. Brooks knew Harvey well. He'd recently accused the boy of having stolen a stereo from him, had threatened to kill Harvey, in fact, for allegedly doing so. 2 days after Harvey disappeared, his mother filed a missing persons report. She would later add to the file a detail that could have been a break in the case, the fact that David Brooks had threatened to kill her son. Instead, the police used this tidbit to deduce that Harvey had fled town as a result of the threat and was just another runaway. In the end, Harvey would end up buried under the boat shed with the others, wrapped in plastic, a bullet hole in his head. Around this time, Coral recruited his second accomplice. 15-year-old Elmer Wayne Henley came from a broken home, split by alcoholism and the abuse his father doled out on Wayne's mother, along with himself and his three younger brothers. When Henley made the acquaintance of Dean Coral through his friend David Brooks, Coral immediately saw potential in the boy and proposed he come along in some robberies with Brooks and himself. The three soon broke into a few homes, earning Henley some much-needed cash that he shared with his mother as their little unit was struggling. At some point, Henley secured his status as a future accomplice of Coral's by admitting that he'd be willing to kill in the pursuit of making extra money. Coral's next two victims would be friends of Henley's. Henley would actually be a part of the search party, drunkenly handing out flyers and such. It's thought that Henley was not yet fully aware what his new employer and friend were up to, but he may have had suspicions, had to have. All the kids were talking about the missing boys, and unlike the police, most of them felt that something sinister was going on in the heights of Houston. Elmer Wayne Henley would soon become a major player in the drumming up of business for Coral. In stark contrast to Brooks, Henley was outgoing and well-liked, making what Coral would soon propose to him an easy money-making venture, of which he quickly became the Candyman's lead closer. May 29, 1971, a little under 3 months since the murder of Randall Harvey, 13-year-old David Hillegeist and 16-year-old Gregory Malley Winkle go missing while headed to some public swimming. Winkle, along with his mother, had been former employees of the Coral Candy Factory, and Hillegeist had frequented the business as well, playing pool and hanging out on occasion. Winkle called home that night to say he traveled with friends, including young David Hillegeist, to a beach in Freeport and was fine. Authorities would later cite this call as indication that the boys had likely just kept on going off into the world as runaways from this point, much to the disagreement of the boys' parents. Young David Hillegeist had been excited about the approaching school's end, wherein after his family was to take a vacation, of which David had already prepared his bags and had saved up $20 for spending money. David's mother discovered the money still stashed in her little boy's dresser drawer, which raised the question, why would a runaway leave their savings behind? Malley Winkle's family had questions themselves. What kid runs off with only 80 cents in their pocket and nothing but a swimsuit for clothing? The Hillegeist family, rather than heading off for vacation, ended up in Freeport, showing a photo of their missing boy to the unregistering faces of the populace there. Upon returning home, they took to distributing posters along with the widowed mother of Malley Winkle and collected a reward offering $1,000 for information leading to the discovery of the boys. I just mentioned that Elmer Wayne Henley had been a part of this search. He'd spoken to Hillegeist's mother, Dorothy, at one point, drunkenly staring off and in the distance as he did so, the weight of the world in his eyes, and cryptically, yet genuinely, attempted to console her by saying, quote, Miss Hillegeist, David could be right under your nose and you wouldn't realize it. End quote. Henley wasn't yet aware that his new crew was responsible for the boy's disappearance, but that doesn't taper the creep factor in the offer Henley made next, to come by and take her younger son out fishing sometime. An offer that would starch the mother when she recalled the conversation years later. The Hillegeist peppered the police with calls and information they gathered in their tireless search for their son. When they hired a private investigator in desperation, borrowing money to pay for his services, the police force finally took notice and spent time and funds dragging said investigator through court for overstepping. This investigator provided the family with a few leads, one pointing towards a dubious character nicknamed Chicken Joe, who was rumored to be snatching up young men to serve as prostitutes for clients of his. The Hillegeist family spent at least one night camped outside a gay bar in Houston named the Silver Dollar Saloon, watching the door wide-eyed, hoping but at the same time not hoping to see their missing son and brother emerge. The family never gave up. David's mother, Dorothy, discovered that Malley Winkle had a friend who drove a Plymouth GTX, and the vehicle had drawn suspicion amongst local residents. Dorothy would soon spot this vehicle and write down his plate number. She passed the information on to police, who by this point were sick of the Hillegeist family's constant badgering. They didn't follow up on the lead. Had they would have ended up at the door of Dean Coral, the owner of the vehicle, and a man about to ramp up his killing ways with the help of the ambitious Elmer Wayne Henley. 17-year-old Reuben Haney was the next to disappear. On August 17th, 1971. Reuben's grandmother handed him some money so he can go to the movies and escape the summer heat. That night, Reuben called his mother to inform her that he was with David Brooks and would be spending the night. He never returned home. This wasn't the first time a distraught parent had uttered the Brooks name to authorities, but despite this, they failed to follow up and ruled Reuben a runaway. Police would eventually discover Haney, buried beneath Coral's rental shed, wrapped in plastic like the others. Okay, I know this is getting crazy with police stamping runaway in each of these cases, but as I mentioned in the beginning, the force was spread thin. There were 1.3 million people in Houston at this time, and only 2,200 officers, and investigators widely hadn't heard of, let alone seen, the warning signs of a monster like Coral being in their midst before. The term serial killer had yet to even be coined by this point. The early 70s is famously known as being an extremely nomadic time for peace and love-seeking youth. The Heights wasn't the most ideal place to live, and in the minds of investigators who had full plates of workable murders on their tables, it wasn't a stretch to think this many boys were hitting the road. That being said, come on, fellas. I mean, where are the overachievers when you need them? Hey, boss, check out the thumbtacks I pushed in this map regarding recent runaways. Pretty tight cluster on the Heights here. You think we should take a closer look at this or what? Where's that guy? On February 9th of 1972, the police force would have one of their own affected. Willard Branch Jr., the son of a Houston police officer, was enticed to enter Dean Coral's lair by Wayne Henley, with the promise of a party. This marked Henley's first gift to the Candyman in exchange for cash. Once Willard Jr., also affectionately known as Rusty, was fooled by Henley, who expertly pulled off the old handcuff trick, Henley exited, leaving the confused boy in the web of a spider. A spider who had taken up the practice of removing his victim's genitals from time to time, sometimes chewing them off, and placing them in baggies to be later discovered by incredulous authorities. Rusty's father searched tirelessly for his son, right up until he succumbed to a heart attack. I know this is ruthless. Excuse me. This back-to-back-to-back-to-back retelling of the Candyman's murders. Each of these homicides has an even larger story behind it. The story of the fallout that the family suffered. Some of you scream at people like me to tell the stories of the victims. Don't just focus on the killers. They don't deserve the notoriety, you say. And you're right. If my brother or son were casually here, I would probably avoid any tale regarding their death. First of all, this shit is definitely full of oversights. Second of all, what are we getting off on the fact that people died in such a grisly manner? That's pretty much exactly what I'd think if I was one of the family members of these boys and came across this episode. If you're listening, and I hope you're not, we're here to learn and abhor what happened. We're here to feel for your boys, or in the majority of cases, your girls. We're here to learn about the dark capabilities of human beings to equip ourselves with awareness. I've said it before, but the absorption of true crime is an exercise in empathy, at least for the majority of us, and we mean no harm. If anything, we mean to acknowledge your loss and share in it. Because many of us who are attracted to this subject have lost too. And for whatever reason, we're drawn to what we know. Or something like that. The Candyman. Final. Dean Coral had a girlfriend during all this incredibly frequent culling of young men in the Heights. They never had sex. She was under the impression that Coral didn't think it would be right at a wedlock. Dean also had a boyfriend, one who he treated well and was always sweet to. I add this just to make it clear to you that this man, the Candyman, was more than just a monster. He was a functioning monster who had everyone looking the other way while he vampirically drained young blood from the local youth pool and knavishly interacted with the devastated families who at times reached out to him, asking if he'd seen or heard word from their child, remembering that Dean Coral had that factory where their boy used to hang out so frequently. Dean would promise to keep an eye out Meanwhile, he was at times putting that same eye near one of the breathing holes he'd bore into a crate that investigators would later find in a shed in his backyard. Much to their relief, it was empty when they discovered it, save for some strands of human hair. On March 24th of 1972, Frank Aguirre called his mother to let her know he'd be home around 10. Frank didn't like to worry his mother, and had recently made a life decision that he knew had her wondering. Frank had proposed to his 14-year-old girlfriend, Rhonda Williams. Rhonda will make a reappearance in this terrible tale, but for now, we'll say that she was very much in love with her older fiancé, and like Frank's mother, was impressed with his recent behavior, which involved pulling up his bootstraps and taking extra shifts at the local Long John Silver's restaurant he worked at and finishing up his high school education in an effort to prove he was ready to adult. Frank called his young bride-to-be's house as work ended and told her younger sister that he'd be there in 20 minutes. Frank would often bring leftovers like chicken he'd share. Frank was a good, well-meaning guy, but on this night, he ran into a friend of his who wasn't so much. Wayne Henley appeared as Frank was leaving work and invited him over to Dean's to smoke some weed, perhaps huff some paint. Frank took Wayne up on the offer and followed David Brooks' green Corvette and his own 67 Dodge Rambler over to Coral's place, where once inside he was tricked into playing the handcuff game. Once Frank Aguirre was secured, Coral's henchmen helped force Frank onto the torture board, then left Coral to do his thing. Frank's body later would be found buried with others at High Island Beach, his death coming as a result of, quote, air hunger. His mouth gagged and nose sealed with tape, a noose still lay around the boy's neck when his body was unearthed. Wayne Henley showed up at the Aguirre house later on, asking if they'd heard word from Frank. He took some flyers for the distraught family to hand out. Frank's younger sister, Deborah, was later told by a friend that she discovered a bunch of flyers in a ditch. Deborah, who affectionately knew her older brother as Bubba, kept this to herself, not wanting to upset her mother, who was understandably on edge. She hadn't slept easy since the night Frank failed to come home. Frank, who would always knock on his mama's door to ease her mind and let her know he was in safe, had vanished. Police deemed Frank a runaway. The young man, who was saving money and working to make his mama proud, failed to pick up his pay from Long John Silver's and apparently headed off into the world in his Rambler, leaving his fiancée and family to, what, deal with it? Coral and Co. weren't just killing young men. They were destroying families. April 20th, 1972. 17-year-old Mark Scott takes a weekend trip to Mexico and never returns. His desperate family soon receives a postcard reading, quote, I am in Austin for a couple of days. I found a good job. I am making $3 an hour. I'll be home when I get enough to pay my lawyer. End quote. That sounded like a text written while driving. Police are no longer concerned about Mark. The boy had been in some trouble with the law for carrying a knife, so this was an easy crumple and chuck into the runaway bin for investigators. Mark fought his assailants, cutting Coral with a knife, but eventually relenting when faced with a gun, according to David Brooks. In the end, he was beaten down to the point where he allegedly held his hand up to his own head in a shooting gesture. There are some rumors that Mark Scott was a previous accomplice of Coral, but we'll never know that for sure. And also, Mark Scott's body was never found. Coral taught Henley how to strangle on this occasion. The whole group was in on the act now. May 21st, 1972. Friends Billy Botch and Johnny DeLome, 16 years old, go missing. Days later, their parents received letters claiming that the two had taken on a job unloading a truck for a long-haul driver. Billy's father is not convinced. He's a trucker himself and knows that no such job exists. Also, both families don't like the look of the letters. The spelling is too good for one, and the penmanship looks as though it has been laid down nervously. The reality is that the boys ended up tied to Coral's bed the evening of the day they disappeared. Coral strangled Billy once he was through and then had Wayne Henley, who was getting to like this gig, take care of Johnny. According to David Brooks, Henley said, quote, Hey, Johnny. And when Johnny looked over, he shot the boy. This bullet mercilessly rattled around the boy's sinuses, failing to kill him, and by some report, exiting at his ear. Johnny, dazed but still very much alive, looked up at Henley and asked why he'd shot him. Henley pointed the gun at the boy again, to which Johnny began pleading with Henley, "Wayne, please don't." Henley shot him anyways. The next would-be victim was inexplicably released at the behest of David Brooks. 19-year-old Billy Rittinger suffered on the torture board, but in the end was allowed to escape with his life. Rittinger never spoke of the incident. 14 more boys would follow him. This shit's horrific, but certainly shouldn't be swept under the carpet. As from what I can tell, it has been. I have this belief where I feel as though it's disrespectful to the victims not to share what they went through. Disrespectful to minimize it. Despite that personal rule, there are 14 more boys here. And I'm going to probably speed it up a bit. I don't know. I don't think I will. I keep on wanting to have a John Coffey break. You know, the character from The Green Mile, who takes people's pain, then cocks his head back and opens his mouth wide and expels those flies into the air, those coffin flies or whatever they are. This wannabe Hemingway cocktail will have to suffice. Sorry, I'm banging around all over the fucking place. Oh, there's a train. Cool. July 19th, 1972. Stephen Sickman, 17 years old, was eventually wrongly identified as Mark Scott, and the Scott family laid the wrong boy to rest. Ugh. Like I said, Mark Scott's body was never found. It may still be buried at Highland Island Beach somewhere. The dig there was called off after the police chief had had enough, apparently. Once the record was broken, they just stopped digging. And now, after Hurricane Ike, that area is covered in water, I believe. I mean, I hear you, chief, but hey, we can't all be slackers. Grab a shovel, you fuck. Get to the bottom of that. August 21st, 1972. Roy Eugene Bunton. Roy's body was misidentified as Michael Botch. He was eventually returned to his family in 2010 after being exhumed from the grave of Michael Botch. What in the fuck? October 3rd, 1972. Wally Simino, 14, and Richard Hembry, 13. These two pals were spotted by another friend getting into a white van. This friend was told to go away by an older boy when he approached. Wally Simino placed a desperate call to his mother that night, of which he was only able to shout out, quote, "Mama," before the line went dead. November 12, 1972. 19-year-old Richard Kepner disappears on the way to a Heights payphone, where he intended to call his fiancée. His remains would sit unidentified for 11 years after being discovered among the dead at High Island Beach. He was one of the rare victims of whom the family had begrudgingly accepted that he may have in fact been a running away. February 1st, 1973. 17-year-old Joseph Lyles, a budding artist, disappears, leaving an unfinished painting of a Christmas scene on the window of his favorite skating rink. Apparently, seems odd to be painting a Christmas scene in February, but that's the information I have here. Lyle's body would not be discovered until 1983, away from the others on the eroding shore of Jefferson Beach, 75 miles outside of Houston. Lyle's lived close to Coral at the time he disappeared and was taken independent of Brooks or Henley, making this a surprise find and lending credence to the suspicion that the Candyman is responsible for much more than the 28 boys whose deaths we know for certain he initiated. A possible 29th victim has more recently been uncovered by a filmmaker who discovered a Polaroid of a boy in an envelope nestled within Wayne Henley's belongings that his mother packed away in an abandoned bus and that investigators never went through, thoroughly at least, I don't think they went through at all. In this photo, a young man, clearly from the 70s, looks up in desperation, his hands possibly cuffed to Coral's torture board. He looks secured to something. A toolbox resembling Coral's is pictured as well. If you like nightmares, check it out. It's rough. An online sleuth, her name is Polly Penwell, may have successfully identified this boy as being Darren Bruce Hillis, a young man who disappeared from Norfolk, Virginia on March 12th of 1973. Harris was wearing red pants with white stripes when he vanished. The boy in this photo appears to be wearing the same, and there are some striking similarities between the two. I think it's him. This was a period where Henley and Brooks had been distancing themselves from Coral. Henley has been of no help in clearing up where the photo came from. There's a movie coming out that looks promising in this case called In a Madman's World, not on this missing persons case, on this entire case, I should say, was discovered by the creator of the film, Josh Vargas, who was put onto this shit as a friend of his had an uncle who was a victim, I believe. All right, so that's a side road there. Where are we? Oh, just more dead kids. Okay, let's get back to that. Cool. June 4th, 1973, 15-year-old Billy Ray Lawrence called his father to say he was off to fish with friends for a few days. Billy had been in some trouble with his dad. There was an incident where some pot was found, and Billy had been in deep shit as a result. His father, who wanted the best for his boy, had scared the shit out of Billy by grabbing him by his long hair and forcing the slender rebel to flush his stash down the toilet, lending credence later to the fact that he might have been a runaway. Previous to this fishing trip, Billy had started dating a girl 5 years older than him. Nice. And 5 years older? How old was he? 15, so he's dating a 20-year-old. Woof. And had his bike stolen. A $150 bike that he'd been paying off. When Billy Ray didn't return, his father was concerned but not surprised. His son had been having problems at school as well. And when a postcard showed up explaining that Billy had gone to Austin to find work, the man accepted this as fact. In reality, Billy Ray had spent 3 days strapped to Coral's torture board. 3 days. What was I doing 3 days ago? I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. A lot of things happened over the past 3 days. 3 sounds like a pretty small number. Let's go with 72 hours. Billy Ray spent 72 hours on that fucking torture board getting the works before finally being strangled and buried at Lake Sam Ryburn near Coral's family cabin. This site would become the 3rd major burial site of the Candyman. I'm sick of calling him that. Let's just go with Coral. Forgettable name. Oh yeah, that candy guy. What was his name? Dan Corn? Cole? Dean Cole? I fucking forget. You ever heard of Wayne Gacy? It actually bothers me that this guy isn't infamous, because the killers who wanted that shine, like Raider or Gacy, Bundy, got it. But in the end, Coral got what he likely wanted too, by being forgotten, at least by those of us outside of Houston. He was very private, and his crimes went down with him a little, I feel. I think we all need to be talking about this a little more, is what I'm saying, around, you know, dinner tables, before bed with our kids. On a lighter note, Wayne Henley called the Lawrence home asking for Billy about a month after Billy had disappeared. A few days after this call, the Lawrence house was robbed by someone who seemed to know where to look. Had the crew who robbed together in the past gathered some information from Billy over that 3-day ordeal he'd endured on the torture board and used it to rob his father? June 15th, 1973. Shortly after Billy Ray Lawrence was killed, Raymond Blackburn, a 20-year-old from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, was hitchhiking home to see his wife and newborn when Coral and Co. picked him up. His strangled corpse would eventually be exhumed from near the cabin at Lake Sam Ryburn, along with 6 others. Henley casually shared with reporters that the bodies by the cabin were, quote, just some boys he picked up and I helped him. He wrecked him, hit him, killed him, then brought him down here and buried him, end quote. One of these bodies had been covered with a board. Investigators later learned from the talkative, some might say proud, Wayne Henley, that one of the bodies had emerged from the ground at some point and had to be reburied with a board over top. July 7th, 1973. 15-year-old Homer Garcia meets Wayne Henley at driving school and is soon invited to party at Dean's. That night, Homer calls his mom and lets her know he's staying the night with friends. Homer, like so many others, would end up enduring an evening of sadistic torture before being shot and left to bleed out in a bathtub. Homer's brother would later have this to say after the details of Coral Henley and Brooks's many crimes became public. Quote, the Houston Police Department did a terrible job with their lack of investigation and dealing with terrified families who were begging for help to find our missing loved ones. End quote. July 12th, 5 days later, 17-year-old John Sellers goes missing, 2 days short of his birthday. Sellers is the only victim to have been unearthed fully clothed. His death had come after being shot 3 times in the chest with a shotgun. He was bound like the others, but his vehicle had been carelessly burned and was found a week after his disappearance. This was not a murder that was likely planned by Coral, who had proven to be quite meticulous when he had had Frank Aguirre's 67 Dodge Rambler dismantled to get rid of it covertly after they had killed Frank. Investigators believe John Sellers came upon Henley and Brooks while they were burying a body at High Island Beach, and after tying the young man up, they had shot him to death. July 19th, 73. 16-year-old Michael Botch known as Tony by his family and friends, had already lost his brother Billy to Dean Corll and friends before he too went missing. Michael was known to run away from time to time, so for police this was an easy pass and likely confirmed to them that the older Balch son Billy had certainly done the same. This family had now lost three sons, as another, Marvin, had died in a car crash in 1969. Billy Jean Balch Sr., the father of these boys, searched the neighborhood tirelessly. He knew Tony had not run away. His grandmother had just bought him new shoes, and he'd left them behind. Balch Sr. said, quote, "I knew all the places kids normally would go, but I never saw nothing nor heard nothing about either one. That was something different from the other times Tony ran away, too. Just fading like that. That wasn't like Tony one bit." End quote. Michael, aka Tony Balch, would be removed from beneath Corll's rented shed within a month's time, but his body would be put out with the unidentified in a mix-up that saw the Balch family bury the wrong body, the body of, there's so many mix-ups, I'm sorry, I'm mixed up over the mix-ups. And this happened a few times in a horror show unto itself after Corll was finally stopped. July 25th, less than a week later, 17-year-old Charles Cobble and 18-year-old Marty Ray Jones went missing. The two were close friends. Marty had even lived with Charles's family during a rough time. He had been once put in the hospital as a result of a beating from his stepfather. Charles was a skittish boy, full of anxiety, but had found a kinship with his friend Marty. The two were tortured and raped together, but Charles Cobble died first after being shot in front of his friend. Wayne Henley then took to strangling Marty Jones, but couldn't get it done. Corll stepped in to show the boy how it was to be done, then had Henley bury both boys under the boat shed by himself, maybe to punish Henley for being incompetent. The final victim of Dean Corll was 13-year-old James Stanton Dremella. James, who was a blonde-haired, smaller boy, caught Corll's attention as he rode his bike to return some bottles in Pasadena, near Corll's father's house, of which Corll now lived. The same house where they found that crate with the holes in it and the human hair and the shed that I mentioned earlier. This young boy, who his parents affectionately called by his middle name, Stanton, had a girlfriend who he planned on taking to the movies that weekend and was returning the bottles to help save for the date. Corll and his crew pulled up in the white Econoline van and called the boy over to offer some more bottles from their van. James gladly took the extras and headed into the store to return them. When he came back, Corll, Henley, and Brooks were still out front. The boy walked up to thank them, and Corll suggested he come to his place and collect a whole bunch that he had laying around. Stanton Dremella excitedly agreed, likely thrilled with being invited to hang out with older boys. Once in Corll's lair, the boy was strongly advised to call his dad and ask if he could stay at a party for the night. His father gave a firm no and told his son, who never missed curfew, to be home in 20 minutes. James Stanton Dremella was never returned home. It's been said that his murder was so bloody that Corll put on an apron at some point. We'll never know how many boys the Candyman stole from this world, but at least we know that this young one was his last. August 7th, 1973, Wayne Henley invites 19-year-old Tim Curley over to Corll's house to huff paint and chill out. Paint huffing, as I've said, was super popular around this time, as the penalty for being caught doing other recreational drugs like pot was steep in this area, in many areas. So paint huffing it was, plus it was cheap, and paint smells great. Prefer gasoline myself, but, you know, a nice acrylic around 3 a.m. with a cigarette, oh. Pretty sweet. On this night, Henley certainly had designs on cashing his companion into Corll for some funds, but Wayne had decided to invite his friend, now 15-year-old Rhonda Williams, over as well, and she was totally monkey-wrenching the usual routine. Rhonda, who we met earlier as Frank Aguirre's bride-to-be before Frank disappeared, had had an argument with her father and was walking the streets when Henley, who some believe had designs on the girl, picked her up while taking a break from the festivities at Corll's, grab a bite with Tim Curley. Rhonda Williams would later have this to say about Wayne Henley. Quote, Wayne would always tell me that I shouldn't keep waiting for Frank to come back, that he had a feeling he was gone. But I never thought that he might actually have any idea why Frank wouldn't come back. End quote. Coral was not happy with Rhonda being over and let Henley know so. But after reaming Henley out, he suddenly calmed down and broke out the spray paint, of which the kids took turns blasting into a bag, then huffing, before they eventually all passed out under the cold stare of the Candyman. Wayne Henley was awoken just before dawn to the sensation of being secured with cuffs. Coral was in a rage. Rhonda and Tim were both bound and on plastic. Tim had been stripped, and Coral was getting naked too. Man, you blew it bringing that girl, Coral lectured as he turned up the radio. He then grabbed Henley and dragged him into the kitchen, where he shoved a gun in his stomach, and the boy rambled until he managed to convince Coral to spare him. Something Coral had surely planned on doing anyways, but now he had Henley in the spirit to do whatever he asked again. The Candyman ordered his longtime accomplice to take care of the girl while he handled the boy. Coral uncuffed Henley, then went about strapping a terrified Tim Curley, spread-eagled and naked, to the torture board. Rhonda asked Wayne what he was going to do about the whole thing. She couldn't believe her eyes. She was half in a daze and may have thought she was even dreaming. In a moment of clarity, Wayne Henley couldn't believe his eyes either. He promised the girl he'd get her out of this, then picked up a pistol from a nightstand and ordered Coral to stop what he was beginning to inflict on his friend. Coral whirled around, naked and in a rage. He stepped past an oversized dildo and screamed at Henley to kill him. Chorused that the boy didn't have the guts. But of course Henley did. Coral should have known this better than anyone. He'd taken on the boy as his apprentice in murder, after all. David Brooks may have been more the type to think it through. Dean Coral believed he had both of his apprentices under his thumb. He knew they depended on him for cash and had become his brothers in blood. They had nowhere to go. Could only soldier on in this parade of mayhem behind the ringleader, the Pied Piper, the Candyman. What Coral hadn't factored in was that he'd just created a hero moment for Henley, and the volatile young man seized it. He fired, repeatedly, sending Coral spinning and unceremoniously landing in a naked heap on the floor, dead, abruptly ending the nightmare. Henley then proceeded to call the cops, who were forced to face what they'd been denying. Wayne Henley and eventually a flabbergasted David Brooks led a disbelieving crew of officials to the burial site. I say flabbergasted because Brooks was in shock that Henley was just spilling his guts. Surely this could have been pinned squarely on Coral, but Wayne was hopped up on that hero buzz. Henley and Brooks are still in prison for their part in these crimes today. The extent of the Candyman's evil will never be known, but you can be damn sure that it's somehow more than what I just expelled.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.